Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Coming up, a renewed debate over the word genocide. But first, a Saudi businessman who stirred controversy because of remarks he made after 9/11 is donating $20 million each to Georgetown and Harvard University to promote interfaith understanding between Christians and Muslims. Al-Waleed bin Talal tried to donate $10 million to the Twin Towers Fund right after 9/11, but former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani rejected the gift after Al-Waleed sent an accompanying press release which referred to the slaughter of Palestinians at the hands of Israelis. Charlie Radin is a reporter from the Boston Globe. He was Middle East correspondent for the Globe for 4 years, and he returned to Boston just recently. And Charlie, Mr. Al-Waleed is the fifth richest man in the world. He's a close nephew of the Saudi king. As we just said, he's been controversial in the past in the U.S., but how is he seen in Saudi Arabia?
He really represents one side of a very important split in Saudi Arabia. People who do want more consideration for the Palestinians, but also have offered cover for the best peace plan on the table, and who are invested both personally and financially in the United States. So he really represents this side of things in Saudi Arabia much more than the fundamental Islamic reject the West group that is the other side.
Well, in fact, because of that, tell us more about how his gift might reverberate in the Middle East. He also backs American study centers in Cairo and Beirut. As you mentioned, he's American educated with ties to the U.S. Tell us more about this split that he represents in Saudi Arabia.
Well, it's certainly not just in Saudi Arabia. You see it in Jordan, where King Abdullah, who would be like the Saudi royalty of Al-Waleed, invested and interested in bridging rather than deepening the divide between the West and the Islamic world. You know, Abdullah has recently done some extraordinary things, most prominently inviting a group of American rabbis to confer with him in Washington about Jewish-Muslim religious understanding. You see it in Lebanon, where the upfront leaders of society are not hostile to the West, and they're being picked off from day to day, like Duaney, the newspaper editor, who was blown up yesterday, who was really just a journalist and a real leader of the fight for an independent Lebanon.
Well, in fact, Charlie Radin, you knew the journalist who was killed in the car bomb. Tell us more about his loss and what that signifies.
Well, I think it's a huge loss for the effort to get Syria out of Lebanon. This, I would say, is the most significant assassination since the assassination of Rafiq Hariri. Tuaini, he's third-generation leader of one of the most influential papers in Lebanon, absolutely fearless in this issue. You have this arc that goes from Saudi Arabia through Jordan to Syria and Lebanon with, the Israelis on one side of it and the Iraqis and Iranians on another side of it. This is building steam. This is a situation that is going to, my gut says, in the next year or two is going to reach a tipping point. And we don't know what the tipping point is, which way it's going to tip.
But you mean equally the sort of tension between those who want to forge more ties with the U.S. and more understanding and those who don't?
Sure. I mean, this is the real stake in Iraq, For all the bad reasons for getting into it, if Iraq comes out of the thing as a democratically governed country with an economy the size it has the potential to and starts operating that way in the region, it's a very big factor.
Well, Charlie, you've spent a lot of time in the region. You were in Saudi Arabia just last year. Is someone like Al-Waleed bin Talal pro-American? He supports forging understanding with the U.S., putting himself at risk for arguing for closer ties between the East and the West?
Oh, I think so. Not much more so than most members of the royal family. And something that it's always important to remember about bin Laden is that for many years, his primary target was the Saudi royal family, and that the Palestinian cause and the Iraqi insurgency cause and the Taliban cause all came along in the wake of that. So anyone in the royal family in Saudi Arabia who does not want to keep the sort of the founding bargain of the Saudi state, which was that the fundamentalists were going to control religion there, anyone who doesn't want to have that bargain last forever, I would say, is at peril.
Well, and as you point out, there may be those in the U.S. who are angry at him because of past comments about Palestinians and Israelis. This proposal to have study centers, does it come with any strings attached? Is there any sense of who gets to decide what gets taught?
You know, I don't think so. There's some outstanding people in Islamic studies at Harvard and at Georgetown, and I don't think he'll be wagging the dog with this kind of money.
Charlie Radin, reporter for the Boston Globe. Charlie, thanks for speaking with us.
Pleasure, Robin. Good to talk with you.
A federal lawsuit filed against education officials here in Massachusetts is sparking a new debate about history and how controversial events are presented to students. The event in question is known by most historians as the Armenian Genocide, the belief that Muslim Turks methodically killed 1.5 million Christian Armenians beginning in 1915. But Turkey says the deaths were the unfortunate offshoot of war, as Armenians sided with the invading Russians, bringing on the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. The lawsuit seeks to restore the Turkish point of view to curriculum guidelines. The plaintiffs claim Massachusetts education officials bowed to political pressure from Armenians when they removed it in 1999. The head of the State Board of Education denies that. He says the contra-genocide material was removed because it was not based on academic sources. Well, while the lawsuit aims to revert back to old curriculum, Turkey is actually making some movement toward change, with mixed results. The Ministry of Education is quoted as saying that for the first time, Turkish textbooks will contain references to the genocide. But just this fall, the government cracked down on an academic conference on the question of genocide. So both outcomes have been happening in Turkey. Coming up, a history professor will weigh in on the controversy. But first, Bill Schechter teaches American history at Lincoln Sudbury High School here in Massachusetts. He serves as advisor to the students' ACLU club. He was approached by the ACLU to sign on as a plaintiff to this suit, and he joins us from the school. Bill, you say this question of genocide remains unanswered in your mind, but you also say that's not what this case is about. So what is it about?
We are not asking a federal judge to decide who is correct, the Armenians or the Turks. This is a civil liberties case. It has to do with the right of students to hear different points of view and the right of teachers to teach it, even though this is not a mandatory curriculum guideline. Many schools might interpret it as that.
Well, Bill Schechter, let's take up a couple of points that you've made. Isn't there a point where the preponderance of historians is what shapes history? And there are groups, as you know, that claim that the Holocaust never happened.
Right.
Would you teach that as a legitimate alternative point of view? Because by your reasoning, it would seem you'd have to.
I don't think so. I think whether the Holocaust occurred or not is a settled question. And one of the groups that helped settle it are the Germans, who were very obsessive about keeping records. We know about every train that moved in and out of Auschwitz. But in asserting that there is another point of view here, really, I don't look to the Turkish government. And I'm not sure, by the way, that a public opinion in Turkey is changing in as dramatic a fashion as you suggested. Mm. But I actually turned to some American historians of good reputation, one of them certainly an eminent reputation, Bernard Lewis of Princeton University, Gunter Louis, a professor emeritus at UMass who's written a definitive book on the extermination of the gypsies. I don't think history is simply a numbers game, where if you have more people who raise their hands saying, we believe in one interpretation, the question is automatically settled. I think when you have credible historians saying, wait a second, it is not this simple, you do have another point of view, not because two teachers and one student are saying that, but because of people who have been studying these issues for a long time are saying, you know, we disagree. By the way, I hope my Armenian neighbors are correct. It distresses me that anything we're doing is making them unhappy. But truth has its claims in history, and you don't settle a question simply by removing a point of view.
But by the way, Bill, you raise a question, though. I mean, there's a huge Armenian population here in Massachusetts, in Watertown in particular. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from people?
Some say they respect the principle I'm fighting for. They think it's misapplied in this case. And there has been, a certain amount of hate mail and ugly stuff.
This is a very, very passionate issue.
By the way, I would just also say that, where the parallel with the Holocaust falls down in terms of, quote, denial, unquote, is that those historians that I just cited, as well as many Turks, acknowledge that something terrible did happen. It's not quite the same as Holocaust deniers saying, no, 6 million Jews weren't exterminated.
They just don't call it a genocide. And I guess I want to ask, before we pass the phone to your student, I just want to ask, as a history teacher, why don't you think that the death of 1.5 million Christians at the hands of Muslims would qualify as a genocide?
The UN defines genocide as the killing of a people as the result of a deliberate, premeditated policy. So I think that is really what is at issue. And, if we want to educate students as opposed to indoctrinate them, they have to have access to the viewpoints of credible historians who may disagree. And if when they read the Turkish point of view or the point of view of Bernard Lewis and they think it's a lot of bull, well, fine. Their critical faculties have been sharpened.
Bill, I want to speak to the student that's involved in this lawsuit as well. Can you put...
Yes, I think we can get Ted over here.
Okay. Ted Griswold joins us on the phone now.
Hello.
Hey, Ted. I wonder, how did you get involved in this topic? Bill's a teacher. Mr. Schechter is a teacher. What drew you into this?
I agree that it is an issue of censorship. I think that when educators decide that both perspectives are legitimate enough to be included in a curriculum guide, one perspective can't then be removed.
But did you research it? I mean, have you seen the preponderance of historians who agree that it was a genocide?
Yep. I know that the majority perspective is a large majority and the minority perspective is a small minority. But even so, if educators who make curriculum guides decide that both perspectives are legitimate enough to be taught in schools, then a politician can't remove one side.
Do you think that it's legitimate to say that a people that is killed by another people, that constitutes a genocide?
Maybe I do, but I don't think it matters so much what I think. Because the educators who made the state curriculum guide thought that even the perspective of historians who don't think that the Armenian conflict constituted genocide was legitimate. So even if I think that it was a genocide, I would still be suing to restore this minority perspective back to the curriculum guide.
That's Ted Griswold. He's a student at Lincoln Sudbury High School here in Massachusetts. We also spoke with his teacher, Bill Schechter. They're plaintiffs in a lawsuit that seeks to restore Turkey's point of view about what happened after World War I, that the Armenian genocide was not a genocide, but the tragic offshoot of war. Well, after a break, we'll talk to an historian who says history is not about perspectives, it's about evidence, and the evidence shows, there's no question, it was a genocide. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. About a lawsuit filed by Turkish groups, teachers, and a student against education officials here in Massachusetts. Now, the suit seeks to restore the Turkish point of view of the Armenian genocide to high school curriculum guidelines. That point of view that the death of over 1 million Armenians was not genocide, but the tragic offshoot of war. The suit raises questions about how history is taught and how it's written. And we're joined now by someone who's done both. William Keillor is professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's also director of the International History Institute. And Professor Keillor, we've heard the reasons for the lawsuit, that students be exposed to both sides of this issue. And teacher Bill Schechter also says he's not sure what happened at the turn of the century was actually genocide. So first of all, what do you think?
Well, I have to say that based on my study of the secondary works on the subject, that there's no question that it was genocide. The American ambassador to Turkey in 1915 reports to the State Department that he has had firsthand reports from consuls, American consuls in Turkey, who have witnessed the widespread massacre of Armenians. And you know, this was in 1915. This was at the time. This isn't a post hoc interpretation of that. So reports were coming in during World War One, basically validating the fact that there was this massacre of the Armenians in Anatolia.
Hey, Professor, staying with the definition of a genocide and the Armenian genocide in particular, how much does an ideology of ethnic cleansing play into that definition? I mean, there are those who say that there were Turks at that time who also had a political agenda, an ideology of ridding the area of Armenians.
Well, that's true. The Young Turks, who were in charge of the Turkish government at that time, did have this notion that they were going to rid Turkey of non-Turks, and the Armenians were a Christian minority, spoke a different language and had a different ethnic identity than the Turks. And so the fact that the war was going on added great force to this movement, because the concern that the Armenians were identifying with the Russians, who are also Christians, and with whom the Turkish nation was at war.
This happens, of course, in modern times. I'm thinking of recently the debate over genocide in Sudan.
Yeah.
And you were speaking to us about Iraq. How
yes.
would this apply there as well?
Well, as I was thinking about this controversy about the Armenian genocide, I was relating it to the situation in Iraq in the 1980s. Iraq was at war with Iran during that decade. And on a number of occasions, Saddam Hussein's forces massacred Shia in the south. And the justification for that could have been that the Shia in the south represented a kind of a fifth column in Iraq. That is, they identified with their co-religionists in Iran, and therefore they were traitors to the country and had to be dealt with. I think the situation in Turkey in 1915 was analogous. The Armenians were seen as an internal threat because they were Christian, because they identified with the Russians to the north, and therefore had to be dealt with. But I just think that, you know, an attempt to justify what Saddam Hussein did against the Shia in the 1980s is very difficult to sustain on that basis.
Whenever we speak of genocide here on the program, and if we mention the Armenian genocide, we'll hear from people who will say that, you know, it's not been proven that it's a genocide. As an historian, what's the talk about this topic in your circle?
It's been politicized. That is, that Turkey has been an ally of the United States and NATO since the 1950s. After the end of the Cold War, it became an ally of the United States in the War on Terror. And so there's this reluctance to antagonize the Turks and to push them on this issue. And therefore, I think that it gets politicized there. And the same is true, of course, with the Armenian-American community. They don't want people to forget that their ancestors were slaughtered or were deported during World War One, and so it's perfectly understandable that when you have these two groups, the Turks and the Armenians, trying to get their point of view across, that it's going to be a very controversial topic.
But then you have teacher Bill Schechter, attorney Harvey Silverglade, who's handling the lawsuit here in Massachusetts, a tremendously bright student like Ted Griswold, mm-hmm. who again see it as sort of a civil liberties issue and making sure that, you know, both sides, a minority voice is heard. What would you say to them? Because these are tremendously bright, thoughtful people.
Well, I certainly respect their point of view, and I think that they have a right to express that point of view and to hold meetings and to discuss this issue. But when you are writing a textbook, you can't include everything. You have to make judgment calls over and over again. And you can go back to the end of World War II and the decision to drop the atomic bomb. I've had to deal with that in my writing. What do you say to the people who argue that, in fact, the reason that Truman dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki had nothing to do with the Japanese, but it was intended to intimidate the Russians, the Soviet Union? Well, that is a particular point of view, and you might want to include that. But at a certain point, you have to make a judgment and say, no, I've read the literature, and this is what I think, based on my best judgment, explains why Truman dropped the atomic bomb, or why the Japanese were able to attack Pearl Harbor.
And again, that's even a more subjective thing than a genocide. I just want to bring it back to, with the Armenian Genocide, historians feel there is actual hard evidence.
There are dissenting historians, as there are in every issue, including the Holocaust. But the vast majority of historians, and I'm not saying that you have to, you know, have a democratic vote here, but the vast body of historical literature on the Armenian Genocide, I think, makes it clear that it did indeed happen.
Professor Keeler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
William Keeler, Boston University history professor. He's also director of the International History Institute. With food for thought. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll speak to a Massachusetts man who took care of his elderly parents and is now caring for his ailing wife. But if he lived in New York, he would qualify for a full-time home health aide from Medicaid. We'll look at the disparities in the state-to-state Medicaid program. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from Now and Soccer Moms. That was the catchphrase of the 1996 elections. Last year, it was Security Moms and NASCAR Dads. Well, for next year's congressional elections and beyond to 2008, one political consultant is keeping his eye on Starbucks Republicans. We thought we'd get him on the line to tell us more about this new buzzword in waiting. David Beatty is a Florida-based pollster for Democrats. And Dave, who are Starbucks Republicans?
Starbucks Republicans are the urban, suburban, or ex-urban voters, kind of depends on the state. They tend to be fiscally conservative. They tend to be pro-choice. They tend to want government out of, you know, their pocketbook. They want government out of their personal lives as well. So they're kind of torn politically between the taxes and the social issues.
Why Starbucks?
Because of where they tend to live. They tend to live in these urban and suburban areas that, in fact, have lots of Starbucks going into them. They tend to get their coffee from a chain coffee store rather than a local coffee store would also be part of some of how they're different than other voters.
Rather than the diner. Are you saying that the core Republicans wouldn't be caught dead getting a double-double latte mocha thing?
I think that's right. There are a group of Republicans who wouldn't understand these Volvo-driving, Audi-driving Republicans who are still fiscally conservative, who tend to want a limited role of government. But again, they're not completely anti-government. And even if they're religious and go to church, they aren't voting just on abortion as a single issue. They look at privacy as a broader concern, and issues like Terri Schiavo with a government intrusion into personal medical decision raised some real serious red flags with this type of voter.
And why do you think it's important for Democrats to target them and try to win them back?
Well, they're a prime group when you look back at 2004 that were looking at the election and concerned about George W. Bush and both fiscal policy and direction on the war and some concerns about religion, but they simply couldn't bring themselves to vote for Kerry. They didn't trust his convictions. They didn't feel he would necessarily deliver, even if they agreed with him on a set of issues. For Democrats to be successful, they need to be able to reach out to some of these voters that are kind of real swing voters that are concerned about the partisanship on both sides. To do that, Democrats have to offer solutions, of course, not just their own rhetoric.
Well, and that's where the big question mark comes, because Democrats are all over the map, at least on, let's say, withdrawal from Iraq. We know Congressman John Murtha and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi want an immediate pullout. Party Chair Howard Dean says the war isn't winnable. And Hillary Clinton says that we can't immediately leave because we broke it. So it's all over the place. Is that likely to win over these Starbucks Republicans?
I think that the war is an issue that they're concerned with, but more and more they're concerned about the fiscal issues in the country, such as where's the money being spent. So Iraq is one issue, but I don't think they're going to be just voting on that, particularly because their cynicism about government has increased. I feel like neither party is really looking out for them. The Democrats are too liberal. Republicans are too socially conservative. And really, their first choice would be moderate Republican to support if moderate Republicans were running. If not, Democrats need to take that role and kind of seize that issue terrain.
What should Democrats do?
Well, number one, Democrats need to make sure they're able to talk about what their beliefs are and why fiscal responsibility, why responsibility in Iraq are important, and not just complain about the failings of the administration. Voters are aware of those failings, and it's not what they're looking for from Democrats. They're looking for solutions. They're looking for some direction, not just simply criticism, because they've already come to the conclusions that there's serious problems.
Boy, it sounds as if, you know, a John McCain, they might be playing a tug of war over these voters with a John McCain type.
I think that's exactly right. John McCain is one of the reasons he's popular with both Republicans and independents and a large number of Democrats. Is he, to a lot of voters, is not seen as blindly partisan. When he disagrees with his party, he does it publicly, and voters respect that. And that's what they want out of politics, is someone that's going to disagree with their own party, not just say that the other party is all wrong.
Although, when I'm thinking about it, I just can't see John McCain with a cup of, you know, Starbucks in his hand, you know, on the campaign trail.
Just because he might not be drinking it doesn't mean they're not going to vote for him.
Right. David Beatty, again, a pollster for the Democrat Party. Dave, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Happy to do it. Thank you, Robin.
And speaking of fiscal matters, this week members of Congress are rushing to reach agreement on several politically tricky spending bills as the holidays approach. Yesterday, House and Senate negotiators agreed on a domestic spending plan that appeases some lawmakers, in part by extending coverage of drugs like Viagra for an extra year for seniors who sign up for the new Medicare prescription drug benefit. Well, this morning, President Bush visited a retirement community in suburban Washington, where he participated in a discussion on the new drug benefit. The program will help seniors pay for prescription drugs, and it kicks off January 1st. But many seniors haven't signed up yet. Critics say it's too complicated with too many options, and lots of the information is online, inaccessible to seniors. Well, here's how Saturday Night Live spoofed the benefit last weekend.
Come on, old people, get on the train. Get on the drug train, prescription drug train.
With over 60 prescription drug plans with 12 categories and 4 subcategories to choose from, how can I go wrong?
Simply log into www.medicare.gov to get all the facts. And make sure your browser's proxy settings accept cookies. And make sure to click your plan while holding control to open a new tab.
If you like, you can even sign up for an RSS feed, and changes to the policy will be emailed directly to you. Or better yet, have weekly Medicare podcasts sent directly to your MP3 player. Now that takes all the confusion out of it.
You get the point. Well, today the president tried to reassure residents of the Green Spring Village retirement community in Springfield, Virginia. He told them the program is voluntary and help is available over the phone as well as online. Seniors who wait until after May 15th to enroll face penalties in the form of higher monthly premiums. There is talk of extending that deadline, but Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist says that talk is premature. You're listening to Here and Now. One senior who probably wouldn't have any trouble navigating the Medicare websites is Barbara St. Hilaire of Manaway, Ohio. At 69 years old, Barbara is a gamer. She's been playing video games since the days of Asteroids and Space Invaders way back in the 70s. Today, she logs as many as 10 hours a day in her recliner, battling video game bad guys. And MTV recently hired Barbara to review new video games, responding to the fact that nearly 20% of all gamers are over 50 years old. Barbara and her grandson, Timothy, who started a blog about his grandma, join us from the studios of WKSU in Kent, Ohio. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. And Grandma, how did you get started with this? When did you become hooked on games?
I used to belong to a bowling league, and then I went, I'd drop a quarter in the machine, and I'd start playing, and I got hooked on those, and then Atari came out, and I got that, and then when the first Nintendo came out, then I was hooked for good.
And now, Barbara, you have a PlayStation 2, a GameCube, an Xbox. Oh, my nephew's going to be so jealous of you. What is your favorite system?
I don't have a favorite system. Each one of them have their own thing for me. I mean, some games are better on one system than the other system.
And how about your favorite game?
My favorite game of all times is Final Fantasy VII. It's really a lot of strategy and keeps your mind sharp.
Well, you know, I understand that you must all be pretty sharp there in the St. Hilaire home because, Tim, I understand you have 17 game consoles there. Grandma is there, your mom, Linda, and the four kids, four of you. What is that like, Tim, to have 17 game consoles and all these players going on at the same time?
It's very, very loud.
Especially since Grandma's hard of hearing, so.
Well, and I understand, too, Grandma, that you occasionally will talk back to the screen.
I have a tendency to get a little bit violent when I'm playing some of them.
This is her catharsis. If she gets mad at the world, she'll come home and kill zombies. My friends really think that it's beyond strange. You know, I would have birthday parties when I was in elementary school. People would come over and say, dude, your grandma's playing video games in the next room. You do realize this. And I just thought nothing of it. It was just grandma. You know, why? What are your grandmas like? What do they do? And I kind of switched it. I thought that their grandmothers were weird because they would just read books and, you know, bake all day. My grandma played, you know, Mario with me.
And you've started a blog about her. It's called Old Grandma Hardcore. I'm on the site right now. It's got a big headline, Grandma Destroyed Fatal Frame 3 The Tormented. And then there's a picture of you, Barbara, with your fist in the air.
That was a happy moment.
Oh, yeah.
And you're not alone, Barbara, in, as we said, in your generation playing this. There's a website called GameGeezers.com. And as we said, nearly 20% of all gamers are over the age of 50.
Oh, I was surprised that there are so many elderly people out there playing. I mean, I didn't realize it until Tim started his blog and then we start getting all this feedback. And I've made a lot of friends that I've never seen. And it's really great.
Tim, what has this done for your grandma?
Oh, it's done a lot. She has the ability to become excited about something. It's like discussing a good book with somebody, only they have the ability to participate in that book. We'll be driving somewhere and she'll be like, you know, oh, in Resident Evil 4, there's this boss I can't kill. He comes out of this cave and I have to get this rock to fall on him. And she just gets really excited about getting the game done. And all the while, this is, you know, improving her reflexes. It's hard to explain. It gives her something to live for, if that makes any sense. If she can't travel, she can travel through a game. You know, it's not the same thing, but it's worth something.
Mm. Very sweet thought from a grandson. Well, Barbara, I understand you're hoping for an Xbox 360 with the holidays coming up.
I'll get one eventually as soon as I can afford one.
Well, I know, though, Barbara, you have tested one. Tell us all. What do you think about it and what makes you want it so badly?
Oh, I think it's fabulous. I mean, the graphics are so great on there. And what really gets me is the difference in your gaming systems. When it first started out, we went out and got that Atari,
Atari Flashback,
just to show my grandkids what I used to play. And I mean, boy, I mean, it's just so different. I mean, completely different. And it's just getting better and better and better.
We're speaking with Barbara St. Hilaire. She's known as Old Grandma Hardcore on her grandson Tim's blog. All Grandma wants for Christmas is an Xbox 360. I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. When director Peter Jackson began his remake of the 1933 film classic King Kong, he wanted a Kong that audiences could relate to, who could have a real emotional connection with heroine Ann Darrow, as played by Naomi Watts. So Jackson turned to actor Andy Serkis, who through the magic of CG, or computer generation, brought King Kong to life to once again terrorize Manhattan. Actor Andy Serkis also provided the voice and movement of one of the most memorable characters of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, Gollum, the one-time hobbit, often at war with himself and possessed by his love of the ring.
Must have the precious. They stole it from us. Sneaky little hobbitses. Wicked, tricksy, fierce. No. Master? Yes, precious. False. They will cheat you, hurt you, lie. Master's my friend. You don't have any friends.
The New York Times says Andy Serkis redefines acting for the digital age. But how do you create a character when no one sees you? Well, Andy Serkis joins us now on the line to explain. Welcome.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm just fine. And we understand that for King Kong, you did quite a lot of research.
Yeah. I mean, I spent 2 or 3 months at London Zoo working with 4 gorillas there, and then because I wanted to look at gorillas in captivity and in the wild. And then I was very, very lucky, and I got hooked up by the Rwandan Tourism Authority with the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund International and studied a group of 23 wild gorillas in the Virunga volcanoes.
What did you see in gorillas and learn about gorillas that you wanted to bring out in The Big Ape?
There's two things going on, really. There's sort of generic gorilla behavior. You look at how they move, how they eat, how they nest, how they sleep, how they relate, interrelate, and so on. You begin to realize, as you're uncovering all that generic stuff, that, of course, saying I'm going to study gorillas is like saying I'm going to study human beings. They're totally individual. They're all absolutely different from one another, have their own personalities, have their own characters.
So what did you bring to Kong? I mean, what did you want to bring out in him?
Well, Kong, in our version, is like a beaten-up old boxer who's a survivor and has been spent all his life just getting through fighting off aggression from dinosaurs and other creatures, and has actually felt no other feelings other than that all his life. And so what he represents actually in the film is actually a true heart. He's actually a true heart. Kong in the 33 version took Anne, and she was terrified of him, and it was possessive, whereas actually our version is much more about them becoming... Strangely, these two creatures should never bond, and they do, and their bond is very, very strong and powerful, and at the moment where they do bond, it is, of course, the beginning of his downfall. So it is kind of Shakespearean or like a Greek tragedy.
Oh, I had to tell you, I think the story of King Kong is one of the most heartbreaking. I think he's, you know, it kills me that he's so misunderstood.
It is absolutely heartbreaking, and that's where Peter is such an incredibly powerful director, because he understands how to use special effects in a movie, not to show off special effects, but to tell story and to emotionally connect with an audience. So we worked very, very hard at creating the relationship. Basically, working with the incredible Naomi Watts on set, I acted every single scene out with her. I went onto set wearing a gorilla muscle suit and gorilla dentures, and we used a sound system. Basically, it processed my voice and dropped it 3 octaves.
We heard they called it the Kongalizer.
That's it. It's called a Kongalizer, and it's pumped out through these huge speakers, so you always had Kong's presence on set. So when I was roaring or performing the gorilla vocalizations that I'd learned when I was in Rwanda, they came out. You know, his breath, everything about Kong's presence on set was there. And I was lifted up on cranes and scissor lifts to give me extra height. But in actual fact, remarkably, it was very much just like playing a real love of relationship conventionally, two actors looking into each other's eyes and playing those real moments. Once we'd done that, the second part would be playing in the motion capture stage on my own when principal photography ended.
Right, you have to sort of make a movie after a movie when you do a character like this. The
Absolutely.
Motion capture, that's to try to get your motions and so they can be animated?
Kong is a combination of animation and motion capture, but motion capture is actually filming digitally using a suit with dots all over it. You're surrounded by 52 cameras, rather, in the studio. And then these movements are picked up and put into the computer, and in real time, I can see Kong moving on screen. So if I was to lift my arm forward and walk on my knuckles, then I see Kong doing exactly the same thing. And the same with the face. This time around, which was different to Gollum, we used facial motion capture, which is a very sophisticated way of manipulating this CG puppet of Kong's face. So I wore 132 markers on my face, and they are all assigned to the muscles on my face, and they go on your eyelids, so it tracks your eye movement. So if I look up, then Kong looks up. If I look down, Kong looks down. And if I scrunch my nose up, then his does. I mean, it's like wearing a digital mask. And then what I did was got into character and played the scenes again, then playing off Naomi's close-ups that we'd created when we'd been working on set together, so everything was specifically linked and truthful.
Wow, a lot of work. But you also know, I'm sure, that there are a lot of people who don't recognize that. You know, that's not acting because we can't see you. And I'm wondering, you also have a role in King Kong in your own face, Lumpy the Cook.
That's right.
And is this part of a campaign to get you nominated for the Oscar that many think you deserve? It's said that Peter Jackson's company tried to get you nominated as a Gollum in The Two Towers, but Oscar officials said you didn't really appear in the film.
The whole thing about CG, you know, acting a CG role like Gollum or Kong is the process of acting. There's absolutely no difference. I mean, from my point of view as an actor, whether it's Lumpy, whether it's any other character I've ever played in any other film, or a CG role like Gollum or Kong, with a character like Lumpy, for instance, I get my costume and my makeup and other people's artistry to create the look of the character beforehand. And when I play a digital character like Kong, the artistry and the look of the character is applied afterwards.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Andy Serkis, is that, you know, not being recognized as much, even though you've had these two huge roles, is that a relief, or do you sometimes wish for a little more of the limelight that others wish for you?
It really doesn't bother me in the slightest. The buzz that I get from acting and the thrill I've had from playing these two incredible characters over the last 5 years, it's been the most artistically challenging screen roles of my life. And I, for a start, I never thought I'd, you know, get to play a romantic lead, and here I am playing my first romantic lead as a CG gorilla. Well, okay, that's a little different, but the only thing that I would like to happen, I suppose, is people have a really thorough understanding of this kind of acting, because it's not going to go away. There's going to be more of it, and it'll become industry standard. And so I think it's just a matter of education, and as long as people understand what's going on, it doesn't bother me. I love anonymity, and I love, as an actor, it's your greatest tool, in a sense.
Actor Andy Serkis, he appears in Peter Jackson's remake of King Kong as Kong. You also play Gollum, the one-time hobbit. I'm just wondering, does Gollum happen to be in the house nearby?
Kong's chased him away, actually, quite severely, because, you know, he wants his share of the pie now. But I'm sure, in fact, actually, I can just find him for a sec.
You're not talking to anybody. Yes, please, dear, please, say something. You need to be remembered. No, I don't want to be remembered. I hate it.
He's gone. Sorry, he's gone.
Andy Serkis, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
I've finally earned the respect of my nieces and nephews. I've spoken to Gollum. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. If you're traveling, be sure to listen to us on XM Public Radio Channel 133, or you can download our podcasts at WBUR.org. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.